Lhasa. So as we come to the end of the cycle, this, of course, the cycle of shamatha, what I'd like to do is something of a preface, not as long as yesterday. What I'd like to do is show the real complementarity or symmetry between the practices we're doing in the morning and the ones we're doing in the afternoon. In terms of the four immeasurables, we're developing aspirations, we're extending aspirations, we're evening out aspirations that we already have. That is, we already want ourselves to be happy. We don't need to be Phaida Phuket for that. We already want ourselves to be free of suffering, and if we can find the cause of suffering, we want to be free of that. We already feel some empathy for our own well-being, maybe some equanimity. And so those impulses are already there, and as I think that His Holiness Dalai Lama so astutely said, that all of these are rooted in a really absolutely fundamental drive, way deeper than sex drive or death wish or anything that's come out of that milieu, but a really absolutely fundamental drive and a drive and impetus, and that is of caring. I think it captures the term I'm translating from Tibetan, tsewa. It's simply a caring and manifesting as loving kindness for oneself. But then, of course, it doesn't stop there. Apart from a sociopath or a very bizarre character, I don't know that I've ever met anybody for whom the field of caring doesn't extend beyond one's own skin. I don't know that I've ever met anybody that local. And that is, you must have some friends, you know, family, loved ones, relatives, some group that you identify with whom you feel a certain affinity, or to put it really shortly, other people that you care about. And it doesn't even have to be people. It could be your dog. It could be your goldfish. It could be anyone we care for. And so that impulse of caring is there, but it tends to extend out beyond our skin very unevenly. And the parameters tend to be strongly associated with I and mine. So biologically, as the Sonadis Dalai Lama has pointed out quite a number of times, biologically we're already born with some kind of impetus of compassion. We find it most explicitly in terms of a sheer biological imperative of mothers caring for their children. Fathers, maybe, maybe not. But mothers, it's a very unusual mother. I don't say that they don't exist, but a very unusual mother who doesn't care about her own children. It does happen, but that's because, again, even that gets blocked. But it's rare. And so there's something that it just kind of comes with the territory. One could say it's genetically encoded and all of that. So clearly there's a biological imperative there. But it does tend, if we just leave it to nature, then it does have some fairly clearly defined boundaries. My children, not your children. My family, not your family. People of my ethnic group, not your ethnic group. My religion, not your religion. And so forth. And so in terms of loving kindness, compassion, empathetic joy, with whom do you empathize? So soldiers on the battlefield may jump on the hand grenade. Just in a flash, jump on the hand grenade to save the other members of their squad. But they're very happy to hurl multiple hand grenades at other squads. You know? And so exactly what is that? Well, of course, it's my squad. It's my side, the people that wear my uniform, my country, my. And so I recognize the nobility that appears in the military, but I don't know that one ever finds it equally distributed. Except for in 1914, Christmas Eve, Europe, when the soldiers, the French, the German, and English were singing Christmas carols together and playing soccer. It was a very, very brief phase, and it didn't happen as the war got uglier and uglier. That stopped. And of course, the generals didn't want it to happen, so they pulled them apart and they had them posted elsewhere to make sure they wouldn't do that again, because they don't want their soldiers to empathize with the soldiers on the other side, because then you won't pull the trigger. So what is to be cultivated then, or we can put it the other way, what is to be broken down are the barriers. When you find that sense, that field of caring extends this far, but then not that far, there's a barrier. And then through meditation, the cultivation, the extension of this impulse of caring manifesting as loving kindness, compassion, empathy, then break down the barrier. And then we say, oh, there's another barrier. Okay, we'll break this one down. There's another. Okay, we'll break this one down. Until there is such a thing, just as there is such a thing as achieving shamatha, it does happen. There, is such a thing as achieving immeasurable loving kindness. You arrive, and then you have arrived. You're no longer cultivating it, you have achieved it. And that's when all the barriers are broken down. It's just your heart opens to loving kindness and no one's excluded, right? And likewise for compassion, empathetic joy. And then, of course, equanimity is the one, having already aroused the first three of the measurables, then equanimity is there to try to really, like the pizza guy with the roller, make sure it's really evenly distributed, right? You get it going. Now, those four immeasurables really culminating in the grand finale of what sounds bland, and in fact really is the grand finale, and that's equanimity. If you compare loving kindness, compassion, and then equanimity, well, whatever. But no, that's the flowering, that's the fruition, the perfection of all the preceding three. That's when you say, okay, now you got it right. Now you're really in a position to achieve the immeasurable degree of all of the preceding three. When you see you're breaking down the barriers, breaking down all I-it relationship with anyone. Now, imagine achieving four immeasurables, that actually your heart is that open. So in terms of, if we think of like there being a prana of caring, that the prana of caring flows unimpededly, unimpededly. Anybody who's read the Attention Revolution or the texts and the teachings on which it's based, you know that's exactly what happens when you achieve shamatha. I mean, it's not exactly the same, but the parallel is striking. And that is when you actually achieve shamatha. You recall? I mean, just having learned about it, whether you've achieved it already or not. But there's this free flow, this breaking down barriers of the flow of prana. It's called Le Lung in Tibetan, dynamic energy, karmic energy in the body. And you get this just kind of rush, like a dam is broken. And the energies are just coursing through, and there's just nothing blocking them. It's kind of like, whoa! Like this unprecedented buoyancy, lightness, pliancy. And I was just speaking with one wonderful geshe, who was that? Alma was there. And Quinn, you were there? Yeah, of course you were. On the pilgrimage we recently had in India. And I spoke with Geshe Alma Samden from Saranat, marvelous monk and geshe and scholar and a human being. And he had a lot of conversations with his Geshe Nyima, who was one rather well-known Galupa geshe who clearly achieved shamatha. So it still is happening recently. And this guy reported, not from some text he'd read, but rather just from his own experience. He said, oh, you know, when I achieved shamatha, I just felt like I could jump over mountains. He couldn't really, and he knew that, so there's no delusion here. But the lightness of the body, as you look at the hill over yonder, he said, yeah, give me a bit of a running start and I can handle that, you know. And, you know, intellectually, you know you can't, but that's the feel of it. That's the feel of it, right? So consider that. Consider that in the body, and then consider something corresponding is happening in terms of the compassion, loving kindness, the caring impulse, that it's free flow. It's all the way up and down free flow. Okay, on the affective side, the cognitive side, the aspirational side, that the alluvial plane of caring is even, there's no blockages. And so having achieved, if you can imagine it, try to imagine it, it's good to imagine, having achieved all four of the four measurables, you've now come to a very even plane, like a new base camp, right? And now you can say, okay, now for what could this be a foundation? So Bruce and I were talking today, what's some of the bigger picture? Of course, I could go on for an hour and a half, but I'm not going to. I'll maybe target 5 o'clock, no later. And that is, you've hit now kind of a new base camp. What could you do here? This is splendid. What you've already achieved is like, whoa, staggering, amazing. Should get a standing applause from every human being on the planet. Way to go, you know. But now, is that it? Is there anything more to be done? And one can say, you've now established a base camp, a new foundation, a new platform for achieving bodhicitta. Because this isn't yet bodhicitta. This is not yet Mahayana. This really accomplished followers of Theravada, the Shravakayana, and so forth, they may achieve this. Of course they do. Why shouldn't they? Right? It ends at aspiration. It doesn't venture into great compassion, great loving kindness. It doesn't go as far as bodhicitta. But if for those of you who have some training in Mahayana Buddhism, especially Tibetan Buddhism, you know the very foundation of bodhicitta, without which you just don't have any even growth in bodhicitta, is what? Equanimity. That sense of equality between self and other, but of course between other and other and other. If you don't have that foundation, you're not developing bodhicitta. You're just extending the tendrils of attachment. Oh, I really like you. I really like you. For the sake of you, I'm going to achieve enlightenment. But not you, you know. So that's not bodhicitta. So one can see these four immeasurables. That's the foundation for developing relative bodhicitta. And this is why Atisha, the great Indian master from almost exactly 1,000 years ago, he was chiding the Tibetans. He loved to do that. And he did it on multiple occasions. But he chided the Tibetans. He was this consummate master, scholar, contemplative, bodhisattva, mahasiddha, accomplished meditator. And he watched how the Tibetans were practicing. Now, this is 1,000 years ago. And he said, only you Tibetans know how to develop bodhicitta without developing the four immeasurables. Yes, I am being ironic. And oddly enough, how many people are teaching it nowadays? Frankly, I just don't quite get it. How many times do we have to be knocked on the head by people of the stature of Atisha to say, you know, it's great to go into Mahamudra and Dzogchen and Vajrayana and Dumo and Po and all these esoteric practices and ultimate bodhicitta, but how about the four immeasurables? And what exactly is your notion of Vajrayana without bodhicitta? Or is that just a little liturgy, some little verses you recite 100,000 times and say, mission accomplished? So, there we are. Then we go over to the other side. Now, I'm going to focus on shamatha. Got 15 minutes max. Shamatha. We're going, of course, now to the final exercise that Padmasambhava gives in the text, Natural Liberation. And just as we already have an impulse of caring that then we can extend and bring to this immeasurable state through the cultivation of the four immeasurables, we already have awareness. We already have awareness. We don't get that from Buddhism. We don't get a mind transmission as if we didn't have one already. And of course, we already have a space of mind. People already have an imagination. And when we imagine, of course, we're conjuring up images and ideas and, of course, dreams. We don't have to go to Buddhism to learn how to dream. And all of those dreams are taking place in the space of the mind. Where else would they be taking place, right? But now, without any training, without any theoretical sophistication, if you just kind of go with the herd and believe what everybody around you believes, or at least a lot of people around you believe, then you will be easily duped into thinking that your mind is inside your skull, and therefore the space of your mind is inside the skull, because after all, feelings are in there, and thoughts are over here, and visual perceptions are over here, and sounds are over here. It's a bunch of baloney. You know, it's just sloppy thinking, because all they know is that these different brain parts are correlated with the corresponding mental states. But I don't know, I really do get impatient, so I won't belabor you with my belly aching. But gosh, I wish they would just be sensible, because it's just illogical to think that because two things are correlated, they have to be located in the same place. That's nuts. But it's sloppy thinking, it's easy thinking. And then it gets everybody to think it's just about the brain. And if you're a brain scientist, then the money pours in because everybody thinks everything's just about the brain. Well, what's located inside the skull is the brain. But to think that somehow the brain forms the contours of the space of your mind is just nuts. It really is brainwashing. And we all know that, I mean, experientially. And so I think we've kind of hopefully outgrown that silly notion for which there's no empirical evidence and no rational argument, and yet it just pervades the common press and pervades so many scientific articles as well. Just groupthink, uninformed, dull-witted groupthink. Sorry to be tough, but I don't know what else to call it. And so there we go. The space of the mind, but we already have a space of the mind. And if you want to close your eyes and if you want to visualize something inside your head, you can. So we know that. Visualize a little dot of white light, a little orb of white light right inside in the very center of your head. And you can do it. So images can crop up there, as they can also crop up 1 meter above your head and so forth and so on. So we already have a space of mind, but now what we're doing, and this is where I wanted to kind of push the corollary aspect, as we're extending the field of caring out beyond those narrow parameters that comes just biologically or naturally out of self-centeredness, just as we're doing that and extending the field of caring so that it has no boundary, likewise in this exercise this afternoon, directly taught by Padmasambhava, we're now experientially extending the experience of the space of the mind. How big is the space of your mind? How big is the space of your mind? Can you visualize Bugs Bunny on top of my head? Probably pretty easy. A Bugs Bunny, what was the, no, Mickey Mouse. I have not yet found a person who doesn't know what Mickey Mouse looks like. From Estonia, from Russia, from everybody knows Mickey Mouse. Even my wife, who was born in Croatia, she grew up with Mickey Mouse too. So you can visualize that, which means you know that the space of your mind extends as far as where my head is, because that's where you're visualizing Mickey Mouse, right? So you know that. But now, if I should say, visualize Mickey Mouse 1 kilometer this way, can you do that, or is it just suddenly phase out? I'm sorry, but my awareness doesn't extend that far, right? Well, the easy thing here is to give yourself a target. So, for example, in the Northern Hemisphere, one of the easiest things to identify is the Big Dipper. And I believe in the Southern Hemisphere, the Southern Cross. Really easy, right? So, but Northern, the Big Dipper, wow, is that easy? And you look at it, of course, there's no Dipper there at all. There's just a whole bunch of stars. But for how many? Six, seven stars, just the way they're configured, they lend themselves to a projection. The Dipper wasn't already there, right? But it lends itself to, and we connect the dots. And we connect the dots by superimposing lines and say, oh, there's the Big Dipper, there's the Little Dipper, there's the fish, there's the bear, there's the ram, there's the twins. And then we're, if you get good at this, then you say, oh, yeah. And you're seeing all these images up there because you're painting, you're drawing, connecting dots and finding them. That's how big the space of your mind is. It reaches to the stars. But you have to have a target. It would be hard to just, in midair, say, okay, I'm going to focus my awareness 1 million miles away, but no target, right? Well, the stars give us a nice distant target, and there we are. We're connecting the dots. Or seeing the man on the moon. Or Tibetans look at the moon, and they see a rabbit. A rabbit. A rabbit 237,000 miles away. Big rabbit. So the point here is to extend in all directions the lived experience of the space of the mind, but for that, it needs some exercise. And here's the exercise. I want to give a little preamble to it. I'm still keeping with my time limit. So a few words before the guided meditation I think can be helpful. And some of you have heard this before, no problem. But let me just sit here for a moment. Ah, yeah. Way over here to my left, I'd like you to listen very, very closely, way over to my left. Can you hear quite a faint sound? It's quite low. Way over. It could be a kilometer away. It seems quite distant. Can you listen? Can you hear it? Exactly to my left. Rather low, very faint. It could even be further away. It might be 2 kilometers. It's difficult to say. Can you pick it? Can you hear it? If you can, I congratulate you, because I can't. But what I just, the task I gave you was not nonsensical. It wasn't like, this is gibberish you're talking about. No, that was quite reasonable. Now, when you directed your auditory attention way over yonder, you didn't have to visualize anything. And what would you visualize anyway? Because I just told you it was a low sound. That could be anything. It could be a tractor, it could be a volcano, it could be an earthquake, it could be anything, a truck. So there's no reason to visualize anything. You'll probably get it wrong anyway, since I didn't tell you what it was a sound of, just some kind of a low sound. So you saw when you did that, you know that I wasn't giving you a nearby target, and that would be a different type of attention, right? But something quite distant, 1 kilometer. I didn't say 10 miles, because that would be unreasonable, but something you thought might be feasible, like 1 kilometer away. Yeah, we could hear things 1 kilometer away. It happens. Gunshot, cannon, something like that. But when you did that, you didn't visualize something. At least there was no need to visualize anything. But you were extending your attention way over yonder, out into that auditory field, with kind of an open sensor. Okay, I want to be the good one. I want to be the one that says yes. If you ask me, I want to say yes, I got it. Right. But you didn't need to visualize, and that was my point. And of course, I could do the same thing, say, oh, can you hear that jet way overhead? It must be 5 miles up. Can you hear the jet going up overhead right now? Hear that low rumbling? That 747? You know, and whoosh. No, I can't hear it. And you can get directed down to the right and left and so forth. The point here is that's auditory. It's going out into the auditory field. And now what Padmasambhava is having us do is direct your attention way up in the space of the mind and direct it as far as you can. But don't visualize something, just like shooting a rocket up, and just let it extend as far as you can. And in so doing, what you're doing is extending the space of the mind by attending. We'll go right, we'll go left, we'll go down, and then we'll go on beyond that. And remember this phrase, and it's the common denominator between extending the field of caring and extending the scope, the dimension of the space of the mind. And the mantra, you might be able to guess what I'm about to say, for the moment what you attend to is reality. And that is when we sense, and I think probably more than a couple of us here sense, I just don't really think of myself as a very warm and compassionate and lovey and cuddly kind of person. And so I'm just not very good at those practices of loving kindness and compassion. I'm just not very good at them. Just give me shamatha, you know. And one can easily have that sense, but, you know, I tried to cultivate it and I couldn't, and I don't think the thoughts work very well. The images are just images and so forth. And I sympathize with that. I think it's important not to put oneself in a box and then seal it. I'm just not one of those people. But if we're looking for a common denominator, it is attention. And bearing in mind the etymology of attention, to tend to care for, to look after, to watch over. It's a beautiful word. Beautiful word. Okay, to tend to. And so, if we would like to extend the field of caring to other human beings, to other sentient beings, to beetles and all different kind of animals, etc., if we'd like to extend the field of caring, there is a simple strategy. Start paying attention. Attend closely, especially to people, because we share facial expressions. If I look at a lizard and I look deeply into his eyes, I can't get much. Having a bad day, good day, hungry, restless, wish you had a partner. I can't tell. Just, you know, maybe if I were another lizard, I could kind of pick up the subtlety, the facial expression of a lizard, but I can't. They kind of like, pretty much, I'm out of the scope, you know. So I can attend, but I can't really pick up the nuances of what the lizard's feeling from moment to moment. But human beings, that's the advantage. We have very plastic faces, a lot of muscle groups, I think 35 muscles in the face, and they can be exercised and stretched in all different kinds of ways. And so with facial expression, tone of voice, body language, what people say, by attending closely, then we really can intuit or infer a lot of what's going on. And by attending closely, then other people's well-being, their hopes and fears, joys and sorrows, do become more real. And we don't have to try. It just becomes real. And the easiest way to withdraw, because just as we can extend the field of caring, we can withdraw it too. And that's very easily done. If you want to do anti-dharma and pull in the tentacles of caring, just stop paying attention to anybody. That'll do it. Just start paying attention just to yourself or just to your loved ones or your group or et cetera, et cetera. And just don't pay any attention. Whatever they say, if they're screaming, they're laughing, they're joyous, they're killing each other, not my problem. Not my problem. Take it elsewhere. Not my reality. That's the way to do it. Just don't pay attention. People become unreal just by not paying attention. So I don't think we want to go there, but it is possible. You can definitely retract the field of caring just as you can extend it. And so if it works to contract it, then the good news is it should work also to extend it by attending outwards. And this is one of the advantages of modern media. Where, I mean, most of you, not I so much, although I'm pretty limited. But for right now, for the most part, you're not off the internet, off the telephone, television, and the media, newspapers, and all of that. But there is a boon to having access to that. And that is, it's much easier to care about people all over the world because we're getting the audio, the visual, getting so much information all the time that it is easier to care. And that's a good thing. That's a good thing. So, coming back as we're wrapping up here, our practice this afternoon as we're rounding off will be very much like preparing to run a triathlon. And before you do that, having never run one myself, but at least one person here has, My understanding is you really spend some time, I don't know how long, 5, 10, 15 minutes, before you start just running for an hour or two, however long it may be, you stretch. You really stretch. You stretch this way, stretch that way. You get limber, you get warm, you get energies going, and then you set out. Is that correct? Yeah, more or less, yeah? And so in a similar way, the marathon of awareness is just getting into the flow and staying there. You're just the hot ember sitting on top of the pile of snow and just not doing anything and just letting yourself melt right down to the ground, to the substrate consciousness. But you're not doing anything. You're not going to speed it up. You just do the practice, keep on doing the practice until your awareness has melted right down to the ground, substrate consciousness. But before then, we have these exercises of inversion and release into consciousness, into the agent, into the observer, and now we're going to be extending this way and that way and up and down and up, up, and we're going to limber up a little bit, right? And it's going to extend, experientially extend your experience of the spaciousness of your own mind. Really overcome any notion that it's kind of localized inside this kind of little bundle here. That it's really quite expansive. And in that breathing space, in that flexibility, that malleability, having moved here, here, and so forth, then having done that, now your warm-up exercises are finished. And then sooner or later, if you're really intent on practicing shamatha without a sign and going all the way to achieving shamatha, the long-term marathon where you get into that flow, you get your second breath, you're just in the groove and you're not even thinking about when will I be there, will I be there. You're just right in the flow of running. It's just resting in awareness of awareness, not doing anything at all. You're just the hot coal on the pyramid of snow. And you're just from moment to moment to moment to moment to moment, you're achieving shamatha. And how? By just sustaining a clear, cognizant awareness of being aware. Doing nothing. Not adding on, not complicating. In other words, you're just sitting there ready to discover shamatha, rising up to meet you and engulf you, and your mind has dissolved. So it's as if on the one hand, the substrate consciousness comes up and engulfs you. On the other hand, it's as if your awareness dissolves, the coarse mind melting away, and then you just come to rest. And you're home. You're home in the ground of your continuum. So it's not Buddha nature, it's not ultimate, not nirvana, but you're home. And you've been there so many times. And the Buddhist understands, of course, you have been there so many times. Every time you fall in the deepest sleep, and that must be thousands of times by now, that's your home. Prior to the dream arising, prior to waking up, that's home, except you had your eyes closed. You're probably unconscious. But in the Buddhist worldview, you've been home there every time you've died. You come home. You come home, your mind is collapsed into the substrate consciousness, and you're ready for your next bardo, right? And so this is home. There should be something very familiar about it. And that's where we're going in shamatha without a sign. And it's 5:00. I'm keeping my promise. Settle your body, speech, and mind in the natural states as you've done before. Now let your eyes be at least partially open and evenly rest your awareness in the space in front of you. Without directing your attention to any object or appearance, just rest in the present moment without distraction and without grasping. And now, as if you were shooting a flare straight up into the sky above you, direct your attention up into the space of the mind directly above, as far as your awareness can reach. But taking nothing as an object, having no target that you hit, just extend your awareness upwards into space as far as you can reach. Then let your awareness descend back to its own place, simply coming to rest without being directed anywhere, coming to rest in its own place, holding its own ground, aware of itself. And now extend your awareness out to the right, to your right, out into the space of the mind as far as your awareness can go. Let your eyes remain at rest, disengaged, and focus just your mental awareness out into the space, to your right. and bring your awareness back to the center, where you let it rest effortlessly, not exerting yourself to extend your attention to anything else, but letting it rest right where it is. In the same way, now extend your awareness out into the space of the mind to your left. Practice as before. Let your awareness return to its center. Whatever thoughts arise, release them instantly, and don't deliberately give any attention to any appearances, to any of your six modes of perception. Just rest in the nature of awareness itself. Now direct your awareness directly downwards, not into earth, downwards into the space of the mind, for which there is no natural outer periphery or perimeter. Just direct your attention downwards as far as your awareness can reach. And then as if you were releasing a spring that you had extended to its full extent. Let your awareness rebound right back to its own place, a place of total relaxation, effortless. Now for a little while, let your eyes close. And completely dissociating or disconnecting your mental awareness from visual awareness. Let your perspective, your platform, your locus of mental awareness descend from where it's likely located right now, namely in the head, and see if you can so deeply relax and let go as if you're stepping into an elevator and going two floors down. Let the sense of the location of your awareness descend right down to your heart as if you're looking out from the center of your chest, the heart chakra, and be mindfully present inside your heart, from within your heart. Not attending to the tactile sensations around the heart area, but letting your awareness rest there, quietly illuminating its own nature, just being aware of awareness itself, but from the locus of your heart. Now once again, let your eyes be at least partially open. And now utterly release your awareness into space, not just the space in front, but space all around. As if you were releasing a flock of pigeons that dispersed in all directions. Release your awareness into space, with no object. Whatever thoughts arise, allow them to dissolve right back into the space of the mind from which they emerged. maintain that open presence without distraction, without grasping, but not attending to any object or appearance. Now for the remaining few minutes, begin the marathon of resting in utter simplicity, awareness resting in its own place, holding its own ground. As you are aware of the sheer luminosity, the sheer cognizance of your own awareness, without attending deliberately to anything outside that, just rest in the awareness of awareness. And let's do so in silence. Well, Lasso. So I mentioned just before the meditation that the realization or experience of the four immeasurables is really the indispensable foundation, the platform for authentically developing bodhicitta. Kind of obvious. And now we go to the other side of the fence. This complete resting or dissolution of your mind into the substrate consciousness and achieving this marvelous balance of attention without wobbling into either excitation or laxity, luminous, clear, non-conceptual, blissful. There's another base camp, another platform. And what's that a platform for? It's kind of obvious. It's called shamatha. Shamatha is a platform for vipassana. Vipassana, specifically realization of emptiness, is called ultimate bodhicitta. In the new translation schools, Tsongkhapa, Galupa, and so forth and so on. So shamatha is the platform for ultimate bodhicitta. The four immeasurables are the platform for relative bodhicitta. Or if we shift the terminology over to the Dzogchen, or the great perfection, here ultimate bodhicitta does not refer to realization of emptiness. Ultimate bodhicitta refers to rigpa, Buddha nature, Dhammakaya. But it still holds true. And that is, once you've come to rest in the substrate consciousness, ascertaining it clearly without mediation, with no conceptual filtration, you've rested there. Then we look at the first of the two really bona fide phases of Dzogchen meditation itself. Not all the preliminaries. There are many preliminaries. But when you get right to the very core of Dzogchen meditation, there are just two phases. Tekchu, the breakthrough, the Turtgel, the direct crossing over. And so if we ask in terms of Tekchu, the breakthrough, what are you breaking through? What are you breaking through? What are you breaking through, and what are you breaking through to? So if it's a pane of glass, like a glass window, you see, I want to break through the glass and then get to the other side, right? So what's the pane of glass? What are you breaking through when you're breaking through the practicing Tekchu? And we don't need to speculate, because the first teacher of Dzogchen in this historical era was Prahivachra, or Garab Dorje in Tibetan, and he made it very clear. I've cited this in one text, Meditations of Buddha Skeptic, show the source, that what you're breaking through is a substrate consciousness. That's what you're breaking through. So that's the pane of glass. That's the barrier. You're breaking through this frozen, coalesced, localized domain of consciousness that is yours, individuated. You're breaking through that into an open, infinite consciousness that is out of space and beyond time and not individuated, beyond one and many. That, of course, is Rigpa. And so once you've come to rest in the Rigpa, you've come to rest right in front of that glass pane. You're facing directly, you're immediately experiencing exactly that which needs to be broken through. Now, I have to say, it's a little bit of a mystery to me when so many Dzogchen teachers nowadays are just skipping Dzogchen or marginalizing or say, do it for a month, whatever, don't get in a tizzy about it. Okay. It's not what Padmasambhava taught, or Dujum Lingpo, or Garab Dorje, Prahivajra, and so forth. Okay. But exactly how are you going to break through the substrate consciousness if you've not experienced it? That's kind of a mystery to me. How do you do that? If all you're breaking through is your core psyche, well, you don't need Dzogchen for that. You don't even need Vipassana. All you need is shamatha. Shamatha breaks through the core psyche by melting it into the substrate consciousness. So for so many reasons, it seems like shamatha really is the foundation, the base camp for venturing into Vipassana, which is a fantastic thing to do, or for venturing into Dzogchen itself. Because in fact, there are two routes. One is to directly, and I had heard that from Rinku Thukku, one very fine Lama. And he spoke about this, that you may actually realize Rigpa first, and by the power of your realization of Rigpa, pristine awareness, realize emptiness. Or you may realize emptiness first, as His Holiness Dalai Lama and so many Dzogchen masters teach. First realize emptiness, and then there's your platform for going and then realizing Rigpa. But there are, it seems, two avenues. So that's enough. But I think there is really quite an extraordinary symmetry, a complementarity, a balance between the four immeasurables and these modes of shamatha we hear. And I can praise them to the sky, because I didn't invent anything. I'm not responsible. I get no credit. They're just marvelous practices. Okay, so we have a really long question. You know what I do with those. Put those at the bottom of the heap. I will get to it, though. Don't worry. So I've decided to practice mindfulness of breathing for a while. I have noticed that settling my chakras helps greatly with quieting my body. Your comment, please. Settling the chakras, I don't doubt that happens. It does occur naturally. Since, for example, in Theravada Buddhism, it's quite interesting, and in the Pali Canon, that whole corpus of the Buddha's teachings, that of his teachings and his close disciples, there are no references to chakras, as far as I know, no references to chakras whatsoever, and no references to doing yoga asanas, apart from sit cross-legged and meditate diligently. And so if they were indispensable, if pranayama techniques, nowhere mentioned in the Pali Canon, if pranayama techniques, alternate breathing, holding breath, closing apertures and so forth, if that were really necessary, then the Buddha would have taught it. He was certainly familiar with it. Because those teachings, the teachings of yoga, pranayama, they'd been around a long time before the Buddha. He didn't teach it. I don't see that as dismissive. I do see that as being regarding them as not essential if you want to follow this path he was teaching, right? So I'd say in terms of any special practices for settling the chakras, I don't doubt that they can be valuable. I'm not questioning it, let alone refuting it. But I don't have any up my sleeve. You can speak with Kim about that. But if it helps, it helps. That's the bottom line. Shamatha is simply pragmatic. There's no such thing here as doctrinal orthodoxy. Did you achieve shamatha the right way, or did you achieve it the wrong way? Well, that's a silly question, so we won't need to pursue that one. In brief moments, between going to the infirmary, introspection, introspection, noticed, that is, I, by way of introspection, noticed that the mind rests in its own place. So why practice resting the mind in its own place by itself? Aha, okay, that's a nice one. As I mentioned before, and so I'll reiterate briefly, the three modes of shamatha practice that I'm emphasizing, and there are many, many other good ones, is they are like Russian dolls. So if you're practicing mindfulness of breathing, let's say phase one, in the infirmary, full body awareness, sensing the sensations of the in and out breath throughout the body, as you're doing that, that's where your focus of mindfulness is. But of course, introspectively, you must be monitoring the mind, which means you will be aware of thoughts, whether the mind is getting agitated, dull, and so forth. If you're not doing that, you're not practicing shamatha, or at least not completely, because shamatha must entail mindfulness and introspection. But as you're aware of the thoughts arising, aware of the fact that your mind is balanced or it's falling into excitation or laxity, you're aware of the sensations of the breath arising throughout the body, that may be your explicit knowledge at that time. At any point, I could ask, are you breathing in or out? And you could answer. I might be able to ask, is your mind agitated or is it calm? And you could answer. But something that you already know that may be more implicit is, throughout that whole practice, you are aware of being aware. And that goes with the territory. So it's already there. So the Russian dolls. And then with very few words, settling the mind in its natural state, the same thing. You're explicitly aware, focusing on the space of the mind and its contents, you're monitoring the quality of your attention with introspection, but you're also aware that you're aware. So this is why it's kind of nice to my mind, to approach it gradually, and then as you do so, you're kind of peeling off layers. So when you're confining your awareness within the posture of your body and attending to the sensations of the breath within this field, then you've just peeled off the other sensory domains. That is, sounds, smells, tastes, sights, you're just not interested. So you've peeled them off. Not that they don't arise anymore, but you're not deliberately giving any attention to them, right? But you are aware of the body and you are aware of what's going on in the mind. Then when you go to settling the mind in its natural state, then you peel off something else. You're no longer interested. You peel off or peel away your interest and your deliberate attention to anything arising in the body, including somatic sensations correlated with emotions. They arise, that's fine, but not right now. That is, I'm not interested right now. That'll be another practice, vedana satipatthana, but not settling the mind in its natural state, because that's single-pointedly focused on the space of the mind. And then when you go to awareness of awareness, then you peel off that. You're no longer interested in the thoughts and images or even the space of the mind. Your awareness has simply come home and resting there. So all of these are legitimate practices. And if you're really drawn to awareness of awareness, then go for it. But I would suggest you might want to also get more and more familiar with at least the infirmary, because if you're spending a lot of time in the awareness of awareness, it can make you a little bit hyper, a bit, you know, like wired. Too much brightness without necessarily having enough relaxation, depth, release that you can sustain that pitch of attention that is needed for awareness of awareness. So I call that balancing earth and sky. Okay? So one down, two to go, one of them being long. Start left hemisphere. Anything over here? Yes, we'll start. So you're on the leftist. Go ahead, Miles.
My question is about shamatha in relation to... you talk a lot about how it relates to just developing ethically.
Yeah, that's very true.
And psychologically. But how does it relate to efficacy in the world? Being able to, let's say, intellectual capacity or managerial capacity or the ability, interpersonal skills, building organizations or schools or actually driving home projects, because it seems like if it's divorced from, you know, if it ends up like the pursuit of bodhicitta can be like an isolated thing where it's just you becoming more and more and more compassionate and developing these wonderful qualities, but then when it gets back to the world and actually making the world a better place on a practical level, how do the two relate? How does it just the incremental development along the way, and then the achievement of shamatha as a distinct platform from which to be effective?
Right. So one could spend not only the rest of the time on that, but I can imagine a whole conference on that, a symposium on that. Because these are very important questions. And in terms of, I believe there's going to be a conference here in October on education. Boy, are those questions relevant to that? Enormously, right? And so I'm going to try to be concise because I could really go on this one. And I think what I would say would be meaningful, but I'd like to also be able to attend to this and not just go on too long. But it deserves a very long answer and a lot longer than I'm going to give right now. So if we go right back to the core, let alone achieving shamatha, okay, just how about spending 8 weeks cultivating these qualities? Cultivating the qualities of just overall attentiveness that is common to both the four immeasurables and to shamatha. And that is when we're engaging with people at home, in the workplace, and so forth and so on, bringing a quality of attentiveness. When you come to the front desk and the people there are working, frankly, they're working to serve us, to help us here, are we just treating them as ciphers? Like, I want something, you know, do what I want, you know, get snappy, make it quick. You know, are we? But as I think we've all sensed, those are pretty lovely people up there. And they deserve, and I suspect we are. We're attending them as, they're so nice, they're so warm and friendly, and they're so attentive and so wishing to be of help, that it's pretty easy to treat them not as its. Because we have a sense they're really here for service, and they know what we're doing here too, and they, you know, they're supportive of that. So I'm just giving that as one example. But going back, wherever you're going to, when you leave here on June 1st, if you can bring a greater quality of attentiveness to every individual you encounter, then you don't have any of this cloistered virtue, cloistered compassion that's only good when you're on the meditation cushion, but then you leave it behind when you get out to the real world. Okay? So that's where the four immeasurables would come in, is we are deliberately cultivating on a daily basis this attentiveness to others, both when we're on the meditation cushion, but then when we get off the cushion and we're just experiencing the other people in this room, the staff, we go out for a walk, we go to the sports facility, and so on. That should already be getting into the role of it, right? And then for the shamatha, you spoke of, you know, practical deeds, aspects, endeavors in the world. There's scientific research here, enormously important, and that is if you develop attention skills on one task, and let's take a really crass one, like video games. People are really good at video games. They develop some real concentration, sustained concentration, a lot of clarity, because they have to have very fast reflexes, right? You develop that, and so I learned about this 9 years ago at MIT at a conference. In fact, to a considerable extent, the attention skills you develop while playing video games can be transferred to other tasks. It's not just you're good at video games and you suck at everything else, right? Of course, that type of attention is totally wired. So it's all ego-driven, it's tension-driven, it's effort-driven, and so forth. So you can bring in that same quality of effort-driven attention to other skills, and you may be effective. But now imagine how much more effective you'd be if you can develop comparable degree of stability and vividness, of continuity and clarity, and you're loose, you're relaxed, and you're not exhausting yourself as you're sustaining your attention. So whether it's as being a student or as a teacher, whether problem-solving as a scientific researcher, or a traffic cop, whatever you may be, these qualities should be ubiquitous in their relevance and so be useful for everything. And I think the place to start would be in education. And these attention skills should be trained, should be taught to five-year-olds. Adapt it for them, of course. But, you know, let this be a lifelong habit of developing really good attention skills. Okay? And then the two dovetail. And that's where this one word, attention, goes both ways. We are attending to other sentient beings with loving kindness and a spirit of caring and so forth. And we're attending to our breath. But that too, when we're practicing mindfulness breathing, which on the one hand could be such a trivial exercise. I mean, really trivial, flat, can be enormously meaningful, especially if we approach it from the very beginning in a spirit of loving kindness for ourselves. Here I'm going to do something to soothe my mind, to balance, to heal my mind, to open up the portals of genuine happiness. It's an incredibly profound practice, and yet it can look so superficial, and it can be either one depending on how we approach it. Okay? So your question deserves a lot longer answer, but that'll do for starters, I think. Okay? Okay? And then one red. With all the development of equanimity and non-attachment, what is the role of romantic love, couple relationships, marriages? How would I know? Okay, I have been married a long time ago. Yes, I ventured into fresh romantic relationships. All of these, yeah, they're of a piece. And I would add friendship also, why not? You know, could be cheap by jowl, could be a lot of intermingling among these. I certainly am very, very close friends with my wife and many other people. The role of four immeasurables can be exactly that which determines whether the relationship is an I-it relationship or an I-you relationship. Romantic relationship can be, oh, you are so gorgeous, I love your voice, I love the feel of you, I love how you look, I love your perfume, I love how you walk, I love how you make me happy, I love how you sing, I love how you walk, I love how you blow your nose. Anything. Because you just give me pleasure. And please stay with me forever, because I can't live without you. Because you're the very source of my happiness. So maybe actually I should chain you. Probably, because I really need you. If I just bind you all together so you can't leave, then I'll be really safe. That's one kind of romantic relationship. It's one kind of marriage. Codependent marriage. The other one is there to serve you, right? And then couple relationships. Well, of course, it's all of the same package. And there are friendships. I imagine there are friendships that are completely utilitarian. And business partnership, I think, are often utilitarian. It's completely I-it. You have resources, you have skills, you have a staff and so forth that I don't have. Hey, let's be partners. Put her there, partner. And if you let me down, man, am I going to fire you so quick you won't be able to blink twice, you know? But as long as you serve me well and serve the interests of my side, then put her there. We're friends, right? Wink, wink. You know? Yeah, we're partners. You betcha. Until you screw up and it's your history. Right? So business relationships, friendships, marriages, romantic relationships, and all of these, they can all of them, I mean, name it. A guru-disciple relationship can be I-it. Why wouldn't it? The guru is just a great big, you know, pleasure machine. Please me. Or the guru might, he or she might treat his or her, I'll just say he. A guru-disciple might treat his own disciples as its. You make me feel really good. I'm the guru. I'm important. I'm superior. Oh, I like, please prostrate more. I like that. You know, give me more flowers. You know, I mean, you can itify students. You can itify a teacher. Itify anybody. What the four immeasurables do is it humanizes. It brings warmth. It brings depth. It brings authenticity and meaning to romantic relationships. Of course, one's expression of sexual love can be an expression of of course, attraction, of course that, but also a deep commitment to the other person, a genuine caring for the other person, a love for the other person. It can be an expression of that, you know? As you're receiving, you're giving it, so it can be really a love fest where two people are offering, they're attractive to each other, but often the deep sense of caring for each other as well. And if that's not there, I think the relationship's worthless. And it's bound to crumble, because sooner or later, that person is just not going to deliver the goods. Because the person's a person, and no one human being was designed by God or genetics or anything else. No one human being was ever designed as, you know, like a product, like a pair of glasses or like an iPhone. No human being was ever designed, manufactured, to be the pleasure machine for another person. Everybody's got a 100% total, complete Buddha nature. And the notion that somehow yours got broken in half and you'll have to look around, where's my other half? Where's the other half of my Buddha nature? Oh no, a crocodile? I was hoping it would be a human. Okay. Oh yeah, now right hemisphere, exactly right. And then we'll see how time goes.
Dear Alan and dear friends, my question is about the practice of noble silence.
Noble silence, yeah.
I'm not sure if it's a question or if it's a comment and maybe an aspiration, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. I have noticed in the beginning of our retreat that we're during the dining hall time, we are very close together, and we, mm-hmm. as we eat, we talk, and we have some sure. like a warmth and friendship going
yeah.
on.
Yeah.
And when began this noble silence, I felt that although I like eating silence, I actually like eating uh-huh. silence, I felt that the dining hall became so cold mm-hmm. and people so distant. mm-hmm. And I find it's very weird that we kind of before we used to sit in two tables only, yeah. or three at the most. Now we use the whole hall.
Entropy is taking place.
And yeah. I wonder, for me, I start thinking, well, wouldn't it be a nice idea if we could practice noble silence closer as we eat?
Closer?
And yes, we kind of, why we don't interact. It's like, for me, it became obvious that human beings, we can only interact verbally. Mm-hmm. It's like, I love when people smile to me. Thank you for your smiles. I think noble silence make you smile more beautifully. But sometimes we feel like awkward. We don't know if you look at people and you say hello, or when you just, how are we going to interfere in the silence of the other person? At the same time, I find so poor impoverishing that we can only communicate verbally. How wonderful it would be if we could be closer.
I couldn't understand that last sentence. That we can only communicate
verbally. When we can come close to someone, we have to talk. Yeah. If we have to be silent, we have to be silent.
That's what my question is about.
Wouldn't it be wonderful if it could be close and in silence? So it's like not pilot mm-hmm. reaction thing, having to talk.
I understand.
And we could be too close and could walk and could sit and could just be there and would be a good training.
Yeah.
I don't know if this is a question or if it is...
It's an observation, sure. And observations are welcome here. You express it very nicely, very balanced way. I actually doubt that everybody, I don't really want to do a show of hands right now, but I'm thinking it's an open question, put it that way. An open question whether everybody equally feels that there's a cold atmosphere, an aloof or indifferent atmosphere. I will speak with confidence. I don't. That's not what I sense when I'm there. But I do know that when I'm in there, and now this is just personal and it's not advice, it's just personal. When I'm in the dining hall, I'm really focusing rather single-pointedly on an I-it relationship with my food. I'm not empathizing with it. I'm not developing loving kindness for it. I just want to consume it, frankly. And I want to eat it, chew it well, digest it well. Because, frankly, just me, I'm just happy to be out of there and back meditating. And so... The whole mixture of eating and talking is very much of a Western deal. It's probably much broader than that. But what I can say with a lot of confidence is that if I said, okay, how about once a week we all talk and eat and we have like, you know, big social gathering on Sundays, for example, what I can pretty much guarantee is you're going to find the aftershocks all afternoon. If you're at dinner and you have lunch together, and you get conversation, and this person saying this, and oh, and what about this, and did you hear this, and so forth, and you're talking all over the place, the aftershock will just ripple through the whole afternoon, and then you have dinner, and the aftershock's rippling for the whole evening, And if you have talking over breakfast, that'll ripple through the whole breakfast or the whole morning. And so this is the nature of talking, is that talking always has a referent. And it tends, just as we know that discursive thoughts tend to capture us much more than simple images, talking captures the attention. And so overall, insofar as this is the shamatha retreat, that's just going to really create a lot of noise. That's it. And so that's why I will, since somebody has to be leading this retreat and look like it's me, I'm going to stick with, until we come to the last couple of days, once again we'll segue out as we segued in. So the last couple of days, whether it's two or three, we'll see when the time comes. But a time once again to really socialize. But we also know that merely talking doesn't mean necessarily that there's much empathy or warmth. And people talk over dinner and business lunches and so forth. There's no warmth there at all. It's just business. It's just talking and eating and somehow doing a strange combination of the both, because you can't quite easily have your mouth full of food and be talking at the same time. So it's kind of a multitasking of trying to eat and talk. So it's pretty complicated, and often social talking over food is pretty vacuous. So what I will do, since I am guiding this retreat, I want to give other people a chance, so I'll speak a little bit more. But here's why I do not, I never use the word noble silence. Other people do, I don't. I mean, it's either silent or it's not. Speaking can be noble. Silence may be ignoble. Silence could be aloof and indifferent and uncaring. So the word noble silence is a modern term. You don't find it anywhere in the Pali Canon, the teachings of the Buddha. It's a new one. And it's useful, but I don't use it. But this is why, when I speak of silence, that this is our default mode. That at any time, apart from guided meditations when I'm the only one talking, any time besides that, when we're not here in this room, if you would like to join up with anybody here and just go for a walk someplace and speak from your heart, whatever you like, and whether it's one person or two people, whether it's three or four people, it's fine. There's no monitoring, there's no policing, there's no judging at all, but that it's very deliberate. What very often happens when people are talking and eating at the same time is automatic. You're at the same table, you're the same place, oh, let's start talking, because, well, what else do we do? So that's going to be the policy here. I don't think it needs to be cold or aloof at all. I don't think so. And moreover, there are so many other ways of expressing warmth and attention and concern and caring for others. It's through body language, it can be through the eyes, but also it can just be cultivating in your own heart while your eyes are down, and even without gazing at the other person, as you're just following from your own heart, you may just be breathing out loving kindness as you do so. So I think there are many, many ways of both experiencing and sending forth a sense of warmth, of caring, of loving kindness and compassion, apart from talking over dinner.
I'm sorry, I don't think I expressed myself properly. I just wanted to eat together without talking, in silence, uh-huh. But closer, physically closer.
And I don't want to police that. And you've made your suggestion, and I think it's a perfectly good one. At the same time, I don't want to be police people. Okay, police people, start clustering. But I don't want to. So what I'd like to do is, I think you've made a valid point. And I think also I'm making a valid point that if people are inclined to do that, just to have that sense, a bit of physical intimacy, just close, I mean, intimacy may be too strong a word, but closeness while eating, I think that's great. And if they choose not to, because they just like to be in their own space, just mindfully eating and then just moving right out, I think that's great too. Okay? So what I'd like to do is, I think you've all heard her. I think it was well expressed. I think I did misunderstand a little bit. You corrected me. I appreciate that. And now that we've heard that it's all okay, what I'd like you to do is do exactly what you like. Okay? If you'd like to cluster a little bit more, because you have a sense that there's greater warmth, greater companionship and community in that, I think that's great. But if you'd like to just go up the corner and as if you're in a yogi's cave and you just like to be in your own solitude, I will never judge you, and I hope nobody else does either, because I don't see that as an expression of aloofness. I've spent too much time with yogis who live for years in solitude, and yet when I knock on their door and when I know that it's okay, that I'm not interrupting their meditation, I'm speaking from my own experience here. Man, the warmth is like opening the door and seeing the sun shine out, you know. And they were really in deep solitude, and they were hardly communicating with anybody. They're really in their own space. But boy, you open the door and the warmth is right there immediately. It was already there, waiting to shine forth as soon as the doors open. That's real contemplative practice. That's a real yogi. And if you find a yogi, and I know there are people like this, they may be really intense, really focused, absolutely determined, and spending maybe even years in retreat, but I know it does happen, and I'll never mention the name. But then when they engage with other people, kind of harsh, arrogant, a bit aloof, tough, hostile, and impatient, like, what are you bugging me for? I'm a yogi, you know, like that. It can really go screwy. So the fact that one is spending a lot of time in solitude, whether it's meditating here for 8 hours on the cushion in your own room by yourself, it can make one very self-absorbed. And if you go off and do a three-year retreat, that can make you incredibly absorbed, self-absorbed. For 3 years, you're not attending to anybody outside. It could happen. This is not a criticism of three-year retreats, but it could happen that for 3 years, you're just focusing on I, me, mine. My meditation hut, my practice, my body, my health, my guru, my, and everybody else, well, you're not yogis, and become incredibly selfish. It could happen. It does happen on occasion, right? And this is why even in this little finger snap of 8 weeks that we have together, emphasis on shamatha, emphasis on four immeasurables. And the four immeasurables is exactly designed that we're attending to people outside of our own skin in a very warm and loving and compassionate way. So thank you for sharing your thought. I think you made a very valid point. And then I leave it to everybody to follow your own heart and do whatever you find is most helpful to your practice. But it emphasizes the point that we're here each in an individual retreat. And it's true, 22 hours a day, you're on your own and you have your own room. And we're here collectively. And it's striking that balance. And for each individual, how you strike it will be individual. And I want everybody to have that freedom that you can strike your own balance, that I'm not calling in the shots and saying, this is what the balance should be, and this is how much time. No, I don't want to do that. That we find our own balance, okay? So, now that we're almost out of time and have the longest question, not that long. I'm not Indian. Nor do I have one question, and it's three parts. Hopefully, the first is just a quick answer. Good luck with that. They're all related to the substrate. So let's tack a little bit and not go on much after six. In January this year, I cut my hand and fainted. While unconscious, I became lucid. Oh, very interesting. Enough for me to have the following thoughts. I can't hear anything. It's dark. This is what it must be like when you die. I then became afraid. My girlfriend then splashed water on me, and I came too. Very interesting. Question, was I in the substrate? Chances are, yes. And I think there was a question. Yeah, this is from Gudo. Chances are, yeah. Very interesting account. And the chances that you were in the substrate, very high. Very high. Classically, it said when you faint, go comatose, deep sleep, and dead. Same destination. Yeah, very interesting. And the difference, of course, is dead, you throw water in the face, and it doesn't help. Okay, good. Very interesting. Let's see if we can do another short one. Was I in the substrate? Thinking about your teaching yesterday, I thought how wonderful it would be to be reborn in Tibet 150 years ago. If we could only go retro. I'm with you. I'd love to go back there. And I wondered if I could cultivate the motivation to do so, to go back 150 years in time. Okay. But then remembered that the substrate is tied to time. Very true. And it would not be possible to be reborn in any other time frame but the future. Very true. Yeah, it's relative. It's the arrow of time. The arrow of time, it only goes forward. Question, how can something as immaterial as the substrate consciousness be tied to something equally immaterial as time? Very interesting. And I can't give a short answer. It's a very interesting issue. In fact, I've just been in correspondence with a world-class neurologist about this point. And that is, so now we're dealing with a bit of Buddhist view. But I was conversing with this neurologist not to talk about religion or metaphysics or Buddhism, but rather, how could this be tested empirically? Because he's not a Buddhist, but he's very open-minded, and he's one very bright guy. And so what carries on in the Buddhist view, what carries on from one life to the next, once you're finished, is yes, of course, it's the substrate consciousness or the subtle continuum of mental consciousness, synonymous. And that's immaterial, and it's non-physical. It's non-physical. It has no physical attributes whatsoever, nothing to measure, just not physical at all. So both immaterial, it's not made out of matter, particles of matter, it's not physical, it has no measurable physical qualities. Like an electromagnetic field has physical qualities, but it's not made out of matter, not made out of atoms. Okay? So is that the only thing that carries on? And the answer is no, not from the whole of Mahayana Buddhism, Vajrayana, Dzogchen. What carries on is both something that is non-physical and immaterial, but is indivisible from a continuum of an energy continuum of prana, and that prana is physical. It's not material. It's not composed of atoms, but it is physical. It's located in space. And it's the two are like two sides of the same coin. The consciousness is indivisibly of the same nature as the energy, but the energy is not the same as consciousness. Consciousness is not the same as energy. One is this immaterial aspect, non-physical aspect. The other one is the physical aspect. And it's what's called lung sem, energy mind, subtle energy mind. And the energy is physical, but not material, and the mind is neither material nor physical. So that's what carries on. But that implies then that something physical is transferred from one body to the next fetus, developing embryo. And so since there's a physical component, then it makes sense for it to be located in space. If something has no physical attributes whatsoever, to say it's located here in physical space doesn't mean anything. Like, where's the number one located? Or where's the square root of minus one? Have you bumped into that recently? You know, it has no physical attributes, so it just doesn't make any sense. Or where exactly is justice? It does exist, but where? Inside a courtroom? Where? In the judge's brain? Or halfway in front of him? You know, so when something has no physical attributes, to locate it in space is extremely dubious. And that's why I laugh when I hear so many times people speaking of mental phenomena being inside the brain. They have no physical attributes. What on earth are you talking about here? Except you're just stupidly collapsing two things that are correlated into one thing, because you can study one and you can't study the other. It's really foolishness. So, without my getting on my haranguing again too much, it being physical, it makes sense to speak of this energy-mind continuum being located in space. And because it's located in space, if we pop this into 21st century physics, space, space-time, they're connected. Space-time, ever since general relativity, even special relativity, 1905, space-time are of a piece. They warp and woof, as in general relativity. So now it makes sense. But now could we measure the effects of that subtle continuum of energy that carries on from one life to the next? So the conversation has been, I won't go beyond 605. That should be okay. Interesting experiment, and I've run it by this neurologist, and I think I piqued his interest a little bit. And that is, discoveries have been made, they're authentic mainstream science, that every person's brain exhibits a unique EEG signature. It's not just the EEG patterns, that you can see, and those little squiggly lines, you can see the EEG patterns. They're just patterns, my neurologist friend told me that identical twins are born with the same brain patterns, and it has to do with the shape of the head, the size of the brain, the contours, and so forth. So it's flat. I mean, it's kind of like, okay, whatever. But that's not it. That's not what we're talking about. But a brain signature, and the brain signature is unique to every individual. And moreover, it carries on through time. That's why it's called a signature or a fingerprint, an EEG fingerprint. Now, of course, if you grow from childhood to adulthood, your finger gets larger and larger. But the fingerprint's still identifiable. And a signature, too. If you look at your signature, let's say you're 30, what was your signature like when you were 15 and 20 and 25 and 30? Probably different. But unless you decided at some point you wanted an entirely different signature, you might be able to see, oh, yeah, this is the signature of the same person. It just morphed in certain ways. And if you saw it year by year by year, you say, oh, yeah, well, that's definitely the same signature. It changed over time, like your thumbprint. Signature of EEG may also morph over time, but it's unique to each individual. So then, that's straight science. It's good science. And it's not even controversial science. Why not? What's interesting point here is that EEG signature is something that you can't just look at. You have to tease out of the data with nonlinear Lagrangian transformation analysis. I think I misquoted that a little bit, but it's high-level mathematics. And you have to tease it out, and then you can isolate it and say, okay, there it is. That's the signature. But it's not something you just look at. So then we can ask, what's the source of the signature? And almost, probably every neuroscientist you'll bump into will say, well, the unique characteristics of your brain. Every person's brain is different. So, of course, the thing is to be different. And it has purely biological origin, so there's no mystery. Why are you asking? Right? Oh, no, I'm not quite finished, and then we'll have to take a break. The question will come tomorrow, because people are getting hungry. And I said I'd go to 6:05 at 6:06. I'm going to wrap up really quickly. But what if? What if there is a continuum of energy mind that carries over from one life to another? Just not that it's a religious belief or that Buddhism is right. What if it's just true, regardless of what the Buddhist tradition said? What if it's just true that something physical is transferred over, and that continuum, according to Buddhism, is uniquely configured by your karma, your memories, your abilities, and so forth, uniquely configured, just like an electromagnetic field can be configured by the energy you put into it and then transmit from your laptop to another laptop, uniquely configured field. What if that's the case? What if it were true? Just what if? And what if when that energy mind comes into this newborn fetus, embryo, that it's coming in and imprinting that tissue, the brain matter, with a unique energy configuration that's going to have an impact, a unique impact on that brain, such that the actual source of the uniqueness, and after all, EEG is energy, energy formations, patterns. What if the uniqueness of the EEG was actually primarily attributed to the energy mind that comes in? What if? It's just a question. It's not indoctrination. What if? Well, if that were the case, if the uniqueness of the EEG signature was actually due to the energy mind coming in from the past life, then if you could identify the EEG signature of some old dying yogi who's a Rinpoche, whose tukul will definitely be looked for, and imagine perhaps authentically identified, and you nail the signature there, and then you wait for the little kid to grow up a little bit, you know, so you don't freak him out by putting on an EEG cap. And if you found the same EEG signature, that would be the first physical proof of continuity from one life to the next. Now, there's another way of doing it, which is faster. Dujum Rinpoche, who is said to be the mind tuku of Dujum Lingpa, great lama, formidable, head of the Nyingma order for many, many years, passed away something like 20 years ago, something like 1991, something like that. According to the Dalai Lama and many of the great lamas of the Nyingma tradition, he bifurcated. That is, he didn't take birth in one place, he took birth in two, one in Tibet, one in Bhutan. They're both validated or authenticated by the Dalai Lama, as well as other great Dingo Kenshin Rinpoche, and who knows, I don't know exactly which lamas, but really the heavyweights of the Nyingma tradition said, yeah, there too. You got a problem with that? You know? So let's imagine it's true. Well, I wonder if those two young men, I wonder if they have the same signature. Say again?
Sorry, are they both mind?
Dujum Rinpoche was regarded as the mind emanation of Dujum Lingpa.
Are the two yangtzes the same mind emanations, or are they mind and body?
That I don't know. All I know is that they're both said to be tukus. Just reincarnation tukus of Dujum Rinpoche. That's all I've heard. The nuances of that, I don't know. And somebody told me recently that there was one old geshe, a very accomplished yogi, in Copan, Nepal, and he died some years ago. And what I heard, this is hearsay, but somebody told me that he's got two tukus out there as well, and they're probably both in India or Nepal. I don't know. But that'd be so easy. You know, just check two guys that are said to be tukus of the same person. You got the same EEG signature or not. If they don't, that doesn't prove that they're not tukus. That just proves they don't have the same EEG signature. But if they had the same EEG signature, that'd be a showstopper. So this is what I find interesting. I have a lot of faith in the Buddha Dharma. And that's my business. But I get pretty excited when I think, where could we put it at the empirical test, that it can actually become public. That could be interesting. So we're living in exciting times. Enjoy your dinner. I went 5 minutes over. My apologies. I hope you enjoy your dinner, and see you tomorrow morning.